Please rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Conley, Judge Werke, Judge Wheelock, the Honorable Francis J. Conley presiding.
Thank you. Let's all be seated. Good morning. Our first case this morning is 824-1396, State of Minnesota versus Joseph Harrison Baines. As all parties are aware, the appellant will have 15 minutes for their argument in chief, respondent will have 15 minutes, and finally, the appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Whenever you're ready, if you can just approach the microphone, adjust the podium, it goes up and down to your level, and begin by telling us who you are in a loud, clear voice, please.
Good morning. Joseph G. Vaccaro, here for appellant Joseph Harrison Baines. May it please the court, opposing counsel, there would be no dispute regarding the outcome of this appeal if Mr. Baines had been convicted at his trial. And that is because it is clear, as Judge Johnson ruled, that the order for protection in this case, as a matter of law, did not exist on the dates in question. It is plain from the language of the complaint and also the jury instructions that although the state may have been able to muster other evidence against Mr. Baines that could have presented a legally sufficient case in terms of the predicate acts that constitute stalking, it chose to rely on a single incident of terroristic threats and perhaps multiple instances of an order for protection violation. The probable cause statement in the complaint contains only a single allegation of terroristic threats. It does not contain multiple allegations of terroristic threats, which would be sufficient to convict Mr. Baines of stalking had they been made. The jury instructions further emphasize that this is the theory the state was relying on. In fact, in the portion of the instructions related to the order for protection, one of the elements that's listed is an order for protection exists, and the jury is told that if an order for protection did not exist, that they must find Mr. Baines not guilty. Now, there is a slight procedural wrinkle here in that following the mistrial, the complaint was amended to include other offenses. However, when we look at the rules of criminal procedure, and specifically as they relate to appeals, it's clear that allowing the state to proceed on this new complaint would render both the double jeopardy protections of the Constitution and the rules meaningless. As following a mistrial, there is no restriction on when the state can amend a complaint, and simply following a mistrial, the state could charge out new offenses that would, if the defendant had been acquitted, be barred under serial prosecution.
But he wasn't charged with offenses that he was acquitted on. I mean, I think your argument is very creative, but I can't make that leap. He was charged with an offense, and he was recharged with that offense. There was never a jury verdict.
The Scott case, I think, is where we need to go here. And the Scott case is clear. There's no temporal element attached to when a judge effectively grants a judgment of acquittal. And when Judge Johnson found at the district court level that as a matter of law, Mr. Baines could not have violated the order for protection, as it says in Scott, the judge issued an order that negates an essential element of the state's case. Quite simply, what was supposed to happen at trial was that when the state rested and after jeopardy had attached, Mr. Baines' trial counsel should have stood up and said that this order for protection is not valid. It expired before it was validly served, and binding case law says that order did not exist and could not be violated.
The jury instruction indicates criminal act of violation of an OFP. It doesn't say conviction, so how do we get around that?
He is charged with stalking, and what the state needs to prove is not that he was convicted of violating an OFP, but that he did violate an OFP. That's what the state is trying to prove, is that on the dates in the complaint, Mr. Baines violated an order for protection. There was no order for protection that existed as a matter of law.
Found another predicate offense based on the testimony that was presented?
The jury could have found that, but Mr. Baines is on notice, is not being tried for any possible predicate offense. He's being tried for the predicate offenses that are listed in the complaint and upon which the jury is instructed. He's not required to sit down and look at the stalking statute and say, is it possible that my conduct constituted any of the dozen or so predicate offenses that could substantiate a stalking charge? The state selected the predicate offenses, and Mr. Baines met those charges at trial. This would be no different than, say...
We don't have control over juries. They don't have to buy into the state's theory or presentation of the case. They hear the evidence, they're given their jury instructions, and they follow the law.
Yes, and that's what the jury was supposed to do here, was to follow the law. And the law says that there is no order for protection that's violated. You don't...
Well, let's set that aside.
Okay.
We move on. We have the new charges. I get where you're at as far as the hung jury and the state then retrying it. So I want you to move on to that element of it.
The new charges?
The new charges.
Quite simply, double jeopardy is a jurisdictional bar. After the state presents an insufficient case as a matter of law, the state is not free to recharge the defendant with either the court's jurisdiction terminates. I don't think we would dispute that. If Mr. Baines had been found not guilty and new charges were brought up arising out of this incident, he would be protected by both double jeopardy and the statutory bar on serial prosecution.
If he'd been found not guilty.
If he'd been found not guilty. And also if he'd been found guilty. I mean, he couldn't be tried on this. And the issue here is that there was a legal error made by both the district court and his trial counsel in allowing the theory of the case presented by the state that there was a valid order for protection that had been violated to go to the jury. And it is not disputed that as a matter of law, it was impossible for him to violate an order for protection on the date in question.
So, go ahead.
Did the state present evidence of three different threats of violence offenses?
The state could have, the state presented evidence of what may have constituted separate actions of threats of violence, but that's not what the jury was instructed on. The threats of violence were also presented in the context of history of the relationship evidence as permitted by statute. But it's plain from the complaint that Mr. Baines is only on notice that at trial he has to meet a single allegation of a threat of violence and perhaps multiple instances of violation of an order for protection.
But you would agree that the evidence was presented for the three threats of violence offenses?
I would agree with that, but I would say that the state didn't charge that. It would be no different than if there was also evidence presented in a DWI case that the defendant was speeding, that the evidence would be sufficient to convict the defendant of speeding, but he wasn't charged with speeding. So that's not for the jury to consider, and that's not a charge that's before the court.
Are you conflating the elements of the offense with the charged offense?
I think those are synonymous. The elements of the charge defense are what the state needs to prove. And there's many offenses under the law present different theories of theft. For example, correct? We could charge someone with just straight up theft, taking my laptop from me as I sit at this table. Now, if I were to lose my laptop and leaving the courthouse, and someone took it and didn't make reasonable efforts to return it to me, they would still be charged with theft, but the elements to convict them of theft would be different. And if they were charged with stealing my laptop as though they'd taken it from me directly and not wrongly appropriated lost property, the state would have presented sufficient evidence to convict me of theft, but not on the theory that is contained in the complaint.
Judge Johnson has issued in his order a discussion of Burks versus United States and points out why this case is so different, because in Burks, of course, there was a decision. In this case, it was a hung jury. So are you back? Why would that not be? Why is that not a correct holding?
Because the position of Burks is broader than what Judge Johnson reads it as. What Burks says is that once the state has presented insufficient evidence, it doesn't get another bite at the apple. Although Burks is dealing with a case where a conviction
But then, I mean, I'm reading from the opinion. It says this is the Supreme Court in Burks. But it is quite clear that our decision in Burks did not extend beyond the procedural setting in which it arose. Whereas here, there has only been a mistrial resulting from a hung jury. Burks simply does not require that an appellate court rely on the sufficiency of the evidence because retrial might be barred by the double jeopardy clause. I mean, how do you get around that language in Richardson?
Because
I mean, that seems to be exactly what happened here.
Because of the language contained in Scott, that when Judge Johnson found at that same time that there was no order for protection, Scott says that the double jeopardy protection is broader than that. Anytime the district court issues an opinion negating an essential element of the state's case, it is entering a judgment of acquittal as a matter of law. If the jury had, again, If Mr. Baines had had proper representation at his trial after the state had closed, and even after this case had gone to the jury, his trial counsel would have stood up and said, the state has submitted a theory of the case to the jury that Mr. Baines is guilty because he violated an order for protection. An order for protection did not exist. The state did not appeal Judge Johnson's own finding that that order for protection did not exist, and it's not contested. The state explicitly instructed the jury and relied in the complaint on the idea that Mr. Baines was only guilty of stalking as charged if he violated an order for protection.
The instructions, again, it says the state seeks to meet this element by proving the criminal act of threats of violence, and then there's a time frame, May 31st through June 9th, and the criminal act. Threats, the jury can find however many threats they find from the testimony and the evidence presented, can't they? And if so, why not?
Again, if that's the case, then there's no
we
need.
You don't tell the jury which threat of violence to determine. That's up to them.
We certainly do tell the jury what words constitute a threat and which threats of violence they need to determine beyond a reasonable doubt.
But the jury instruction doesn't say, you must find that he said this in order to find that. It doesn't say that. We don't give the jury that type of a roadmap.
In order to survive a challenge under the particularities clause, the jury must be in unanimous agreement as to all elements of the offense. It must unanimously agree that which threats took place and which violations of an order for protection took place. If the jury would be allowed to convict on multiple terroristic threats, they would need to agree on which language constituted those threats, on which dates those threats occurred, and the state would need to make specific allegations in the complaint as to which statements and which events constituted those multiple terroristic threats, so Mr. Baines would have a full and fair opportunity to meet them at trial. When we look at the probable cause language of the complaint, there is only a single incident of terroristic threats alleged. That's the only act that Mr. Baines is on notice that the state is putting forward as constituting a terroristic threat at trial. Thus, when we further look at the complaint, there are numerous instances of Mr. Baines calling this person from prison, making contact with them, but none of those other contacts are spelled out in such a way that they could be seen as violating, as doing anything other than violating an order for protection. They do not constitute a threat of violence.
Thus, the hung jury.
Well, we don't know why the jury hung. The jury could have hung because it didn't believe the witnesses. The jury could have hung because somebody wanted to nullify.
What does it matter if your client objected to a mistrial, the judge analyzed the ability to declare a mistrial, and it was so declared. So,
Did you ask me if that matters, or you? I don't understand.
I guess I'm asking you.
Sure, I think that does matter. My client did not consent to a mistrial. If a client consents to a mistrial, that's effectively a waiver of double jeopardy protection. That's saying, I agree that this trial was deficient in some way. I'm willing to be retried again. Mr. Baines did not consent to a mistrial.
Correct, and the judge analyzed it based on his refusal to consider this as a mistrial.
Certainly, yes.
So what was the error there?
The error there is the error that I've been talking about this entire argument. The error there is that what the judge should have done is granted a judgment of acquittal. This is no different than if a defendant went to trial on a charge of auto theft and the evidence showed that what was stolen was a bike, and the judge nonetheless denied a motion for judgment of acquittal on the charge of auto theft and declared a mistrial and allowed the defendant to be retried. Sitting here as we look at the state's case, we know that Mr. Baines is not guilty of the theory that was alleged because there was no order for protection at the time. That's not disputed. I don't have anything more, unless the court has more questions.
I don't think we do have any more questions. You will have rebuttal, Mr. Vaccaro.
Thank you.
You're welcome. We'll now hear from counsel for the respondent, please.
Thank you, Your Honor. Counsel, may it please the court. My name is Evan Frazier, Assistant Dakota County Attorney on behalf of Respondent, State of Minnesota. There has been no unanimous decision on appellant's guilt or innocence at this time. No court, no jury, no finder of fact has made a determination that the evidence submitted during appellant's trial was legally insufficient to support a finding of guilty. The district court was asked on three different occasions to do so, after the close of the case in chief of the state, an appellant's motion dated April 11th of 2024, and appellant's motion dated June 27th of 2024. On all of those occasions, the district court declined to do so. I ask that you affirm the ruling of the district court and remand this case back for a second trial. Appellant cites Burks and asks this court to expand that decision past what the Supreme Court has explicitly authorized it to do. And as Judge Connolly, you pointed out, Richardson is clear that it requires an unreversed appellate ruling that the government has failed to introduce sufficient evidence to enter a conviction. And that is not what happened here. There has been no appellate ruling that there is on the sufficiency of the evidence. There is a district court ruling that there was not probable cause to go forward at a second trial on some of the charges that were amended in the complaint. But Burks does not apply, and for that reason, the court should affirm and remand this case for trial based on...
Can we remand it, though? Just procedurally, I'm trying to think through that. So if we affirm, doesn't that mean you just go forth and go on?
Sure, Judge Warkey, and that may be the case, and I don't know if procedurally you have to remand it or not, but the state, the respondent, wants to go forward with a second trial and have the district court's order that double jeopardy does not bar that second trial affirmed. I think as Judge Warkey, as you were kind of pointing out in your questioning to appellant, the district court did review whether there was a manifest necessity at the time the jury hung and whether or not that was sufficient to overcome the double jeopardy clause and allow a second trial. And the court made that determination and determined there was a manifest necessity and ordered a second trial. It was only after that trial was ordered, after there was a determination that there was reason to go back and try this case again, that then we had this pretrial motion practice that went through and ended up with the dismissal of some counts that were charged separately in an amended complaint. That's a trial management issue that certainly limits some of the evidence that the state can present at a second trial here. The state's limited to not being able to bring in evidence of violations of an order for protection. But that is a motion to limine, that is a district court trial management issue that can be handled at the district court. It's not something that the Court of Appeals needs to rule on and force the state to give up this prosecution.
Should we be concerned that there was not sufficient notice to appellant of the predicate offenses that they were alleging?
Judge, I read that in appellant's reply brief, and I took it as kind of an attempt to morph this into a due process argument as to whether or not the probable cause statement of the complaint provided sufficient notice as to what the charge was. I'd note that there is no due process argument that was made at the district court level. There was no ruling on whether the complaint provided sufficient notice under the due process clause. So there is no ruling for the court to determine whether or not the district court's ruling was appropriate on that issue. I would also note the charging language on the face of the complaint alleges that the defendant committed the act of stalking, which is defined by statute as committing two or more of 17 offenses that are listed specifically within the statute. And so appellants on notice that Some of those actions are constituting what the state's charging him with. The voicemails that contained those threats were referenced in the statement of probable cause in the original complaint. Now, the threats weren't explicitly laid out for each one of those, but that evidence was known to appellant. That evidence was, there's no allegation that that evidence wasn't disclosed to appellant. And as the briefing in this case shows at the district court level, the state argued that it did present that evidence that there were threats at the time of the trial. And I would note that as far as the jury instructions go, there was a time range, a date range, listed for both the threats of violence as well as the order for protection violations, indicating that there were potentially multiple of each of those that could constitute the offense of the predicate offenses for the stalking charge. Otherwise, I think the district court would have just said the state's attempting to charge or to show that there were two or more offenses indicating there was a threats of violence on specific date and an order for protection violation on date range. Instead, the district court wrote that there was a date range for both of those indicating that the jury was able to find multiple threats of violence, multiple order for protection, or potentially one of each of those from that date range in order to come up with those predicate offenses. So, Your Honors, a manifest necessity existed which justified the declaration of a mistrial and permits the retrial of appellant for the same acts he was previously tried for. The imposition of the double jeopardy clause would be inappropriate based on the procedural posture and factual record present here. And while the district court has limited the state's ability to argue at retrial, it did not rule that the state possessed insufficient evidence to convict the appellant, and the state asks to affirm the district court's order. If there are no other questions, I would give back the rest of my time.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Frazier.
Thank
Mr.
you, Your Honor.
You're welcome. Mr. Vaccaro, you'll have the last word, sir.
Thank you. I do want to focus on the discussion regarding the sufficiency of the evidence trial and the notice the defendant was placed on. As Mr. Frazier references, there are 17 predicate offenses that can constitute stalking. Quite naturally, the complaint doesn't include any allegations of burglary, criminal defamation. It contains evidence of two of the 17. Critically, also, the allegations that Mr. Frazier's made that these voicemails could have constituted threats of violence. Whether they did so or not, Mr. Baines was never put on notice that that was the state's contention. He never had the ability, no judge ever found probable cause that they did. That's why it's important that the language contained in those voicemails wasn't in the complaint. To say that that's sufficiency of the evidence and that's the theory the state was permitted to proceed on would essentially allow the state to make an end run around Mr. Baines to challenge probable cause that those voicemails constituted terroristic threats under the statute. That's why pleading with specificity is so important both in criminal and civil law. It's important because that puts the defendant on notice of the allegations they are to meet at trial. This would be no different than a burglary case in which the state proves that a defendant entered a home, broke into a safe, caused in excess of $1,000 of damage to the safe, and stole something from the safe. And then later on, the item in the safe was proved following a mistrial to actually belong to the defendant and not be something that the defendant could steal. Now, if the state relied on a theory that the defendant had committed burglary by a predicate act of theft, the defendant would be not guilty. The defendant would also not similarly be...
Hypothetical different if the state then was relying on different instances of theft on different occasions, which it seems to be relying here. I mean, I get that, but if he stole, I don't know, diamonds on a Tuesday, did what you're saying he did on a Wednesday, but then also stole, a gun, on Friday, isn't that different? And why would they all, simply because the second one he was acquitted on or was dismissed, why does that wipe out the other two, which are on different dates? I mean, they're not the same date,
because,
the same incident.
Because the state didn't choose to charge him with that. That's not the offense contained in the complaint. When a defendant...
So you can't do that in an amended complaint because everything is just waived. or rolled into the charge that he was acquitted in or dismissed.
Correct. That's how double jeopardy and that's what the statute barring serial prosecution says, is that this whole thing is a behavioral incident of stalking.
Of what? I agree that you can't have serial prosecution of the same crime, but it's different. How is this to get where you want us to go? Would just seem to me it would almost foreclose any attempt by the state ever to amend a complaint after a mistrial, because you would always say, "Well, you could have pled it, you didn't. Now you're sunk." Which seems to me.
I don't think the state is precluded from amending a complaint following a mistrial where they have presented legally insufficient evidence. I mean,
on that crime, not on other crimes.
And the crime here is stalking.
Go ahead.
The issue is then this is why the bar on serial prosecution exists, is because without it, if Mr. Baines was found not guilty of stalking, then the state could just come back and say, okay, we're charging you now with the predicate offenses that constituted stalking. The bar on serial prosecution exists so that when there is one behavioral incident in question, the question here is Mr. Baines stalking of his ex-girlfriend. When there is one behavioral incident in question, all of the possible criminal offenses that could be charged out of that behavioral incident have to be brought in a single complaint. That's how that bar attaches. Again, if someone is acquitted of DWI and they are not charged with the traffic offense out of which the traffic stop arose, the government can't come back and then charge them with failure to signal a turn, rolling a stop sign, that sort of thing.
If it occurred on the same date. Now, what if they didn't? What if, you know, for whatever reasons, they didn't know he had a DUI either prior to the DUI he was charged with or after? Are you suggesting that because they didn't charge him, he can't be prosecuted for those DUIs, even though he was acquitted of the DUI on, you know, the Tuesday, but he can't be charged with the Friday or the Monday?
If the conduct over, if it's the same behavioral incident, yes. If the state is...
Well, it's not. I mean, it's not the same. I mean, that's why it's different dates, which is why anyway.
I'm out of time. I would just say that we don't measure behavioral incidents in terms of dates. It's the incident itself. It's a flexible category.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Vaccaro. Thank you very much, Mr. Frazier. The matter is submitted. We will issue our decision within 90 days.